Hi, and welcome to I'll Go First. I'm your host, Jessica Minhas. Psychotherapist and Instagram mental health rock star Mina B joins us on this episode. You may have heard her name already or seen her poetry on Instagram already. She is everywhere. Mina has built a huge community fostering hard conversations around mental health care. She and I talk about her journey as a first immigrant child, growing up in dysfunction, struggling with cutting and depression as a teenager, to how she's gotten to where she is today as a role model to so many. I have known Mina for about 10 years now, and it is so fun and so special to bear witness to her story. I think you're really, really going to love her. Let's get started. Oh my gosh, you have exploded. Like, you're famous.
Oh, you sound like my friend. Like,
you're famous. So, yeah, girl. And then I forget where I was, but I was on some, like, 2 million. I was following some Instagram account that had, like, 2 million followers, and they had just put up a post of yours. And I was like, this is bonkers.
What?
Yes. Oh, and I think at the beginning of COVID, you had, how many followers did you have at the beginning? Like in January 1, how many did you have?
Oh, in January, I had like 20,000 followers.
And how many do you have now?
I'm at 85. I actually like never even think of it from that perspective. That is actually insane.
What are your friends saying?
They're saying the same things you're saying. And I'm like, no, I'm not famous. And they're like, yes, you are.
Oh my gosh, Mina, I'm so stinking excited for you. It is so fun to see this, like,
thank you.
And wow. And I think really now it's the right time for mental health.
Yeah, there's such a huge shift. So I think it happened like right on time. And yeah, it's just crazy.
It's wild.
Yeah. Like sometimes I'm still in awe. I'm like, wow.
I know. Like, see guys? See? That's what I've been saying this whole time. Why do you think Instagram is the right medium? Why do you think people resonate so much with that?
That's a really interesting question. I even think back when I started my Instagram page and I would post my donuts and post my brunch and post all these different things of my life. And then I transitioned into posting my writings. I think so many people are on Instagram looking for something that you can find so much on there. And I think that's why so many people gravitate toward it. Cause it's like, if I want to look up home design, I can follow this person. But if I also want to check in with my mental health, I can follow this person. If I want to see nature, I can follow this person who's just a plant. Like literally there's people who have a whole page dedicated to plants, right? So I just think that it's an avenue where you can find so many resources. And then also, I guess because you have the incorporation of like stories and different things like that on Instagram, it also brings in, like, ties you into someone's life.
I think there's a real intimacy.
Yeah.
Too, and I think what you're sharing is really resonates with the secrets that we keep and then we don't know how to talk about, and then we can see it on Instagram. Have you seen something that's given you a lot of hope recently?
I would say I have seen some things that have given me a lot of hope. That's an interesting question too, because when you asked that, I realized I don't think I ever lost hope. I think it just comes from the fact that I've been doing this work forever. So I've already been trained to be resilient around it. This is not something that a week ago I was like, oh my gosh, like, what do I do? Literally from the time I was a child, I've been thinking, what do I do? Because I've been dealing with so much since I was a kid. And even when you tie in race, I experienced racism from the time I was a child. So my eyes were open to the fact that I'm a Black woman in this country. My eyes were also open to the fact that I come from immigrant parents.
Are Jamaican, right?
Panamanian.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So I think for me, because this has always been something I've been cognizant of, I have spent my whole life being proactive and being an advocate for my community that this spark that happened a few weeks ago where this was a wake-up call for some. For me, it was just kind of like, well, we've been dealing with this forever. So I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing. Have I been tired? Yeah. Have I been exhausted? Yeah. You know, is it sad each time I hear these reports about Black people dying? Of course. But to say I've lost hope in the midst of it, I actually realized I never did. Because I'm going to continue. You know what it is too? Because I'm passionate about what I do at my work. And I'm passionate about being Black. I'm passionate about who I am as a person. And I refuse to just let the things that's happening in our country take away my strength. So for me, I'm like, I actually never lost hope. I'm going to keep fighting. I'm going to keep doing what I've been doing my whole life.
What I hear you say is almost like you're in the business. You've always been in the business of hope and resilience. And I think that's interesting given that, like, you know, when we think of mental health practitioners, you're dealing with shame, you're dealing with trauma, you're dealing with assault, you're dealing with all the stuff that's hard. But hearing you say that you've never lost hope is kind of magical.
Yeah. I mean, I actually never even thought about that. And I'm recognizing it now in a place where I think a lot of people have lost hope and they do feel powerless. I think a lot of that comes from when we try to occupy too many lanes and we see so much happening in the world. We want to be the person who changes everything. And for a long time, I guess because I've been dealing with my own mental health issues for a long time, I had to learn that I have to figure out what lane I can occupy and work with what I have. Where trying to fix the whole world is impossible. I'm only one person. However, if I do the work in my circle, then that expands to my community. And when my community grows, they reach out to other communities and those community grow. And then we have this revolution of people who are evolving. My first thing that I had to learn how to occupy was one, the feeling of feeling safe and talking about mental health and recognizing I want to change the world and the stigma in the world. But first, how about I sit with my inner circle and figure out what stigmas they have, right? Or sit with my family, because I come from a family that mental health wasn't necessarily talked about.
I mean, was it talked about? Like you said,
not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not like from what I remember, I feel like in my household, mental health was kind of looked at as like homelessness or drug addiction.
It was looked down on.
Yeah. Yeah. And those were people who struggled with mental health.
So like, it was almost like when they thought of mental health, it was this like extreme addiction, homelessness. It wasn't.
Yeah, it was.
You talk a lot about depression, and that wasn't part of the vernacular.
No. So I feel like in my household, it was kind of not necessarily frowned upon, because I actually don't even feel like my parents or my family members were judgmental about mental health issues. I just think they kind of felt like mental health issues were the extreme. Mm. So if you were sad and depressed, they kind of looked at it as like, you gotta get it together. We don't have the resources for you to be sad all day. You gotta get to school, you gotta get to work. You just gotta pull yourself up by your bootstraps and just get out there, especially coming from immigrant parents. My parents came here in their 20s. And they built their lives here. And so I think a lot of that was just rooted in this idea that sadness was something that you can just get over. Maybe you're having a bad day.
You got to work harder.
Yeah.
Have work
gotta
ethic. You got to
work harder. Right. And that was
mental health. Right. Yeah.
Right. And that's
it's
how
like a self-defeating prophecy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I feel like that's pretty much how my family viewed mental health. I never saw them say, you know, people are crazy. I never saw them say, I mean, they probably have said those things because I feel like that's a very common stereotype, but I don't necessarily feel like they've ever shamed anyone in the mental health community. But I do think that their idea of what mental health was not that we all have mental health. It was just that there's a select few people. And I think people confuse the difference between our well-being, which is our mental health, versus a mental illness, which is an actual diagnosis. And I think my family kind of just assumed it was the extreme where if you're poor, if you're homeless, you probably have some sort of mental health issue. If you have a drug addiction, you probably have some sort of mental health issue. But if you're crying all day, if you have poor appetite, you know, if it's hard for you to get out of bed and do certain daily tasks, sounds like you're not trying hard enough.
And you have said in other interviews that your experience really started when you were young.
Yeah.
When you first started realizing that there was, I mean, it sounds like you knew you were different all around, like how you looked compared to your classmates. You talk a lot about bullying, being really tall compared to everyone.
Yeah.
And then also just feeling different in terms of like depression. I thought that was really interesting that you kind of have had an awareness around depression at five.
Yeah, like when I was five, I didn't know that I was depressed, but I knew something was wrong. I always knew something was wrong. I was a kid who I cried frequently. I remember when I was in preschool, and for some reason, I just always felt different. Just always felt different. And I guess it's, I don't know if it's because I looked different. And when I say look different, more so I was always tall. Now, as a grown woman, I'm 5'10". To me, that's not that tall. But when you're a child and you're like super, super tall compared to your classmates, you see those things. And oftentimes people assume that you are in an older group of peers and you're not. And so I remember when I was in preschool, I had this teacher who would, I would cry almost every nap time. Every nap time I wanted my mom. And she would play Mariah Carey's Hero song and pat my back to fall asleep. And it was such a beautiful, it's one of those moments that I still remember because she did that specifically for me. She didn't need to play that song. She didn't have to rub my back, but she knew what I needed. And she took the time out to learn me. She took the time out to figure out how could she nurture me. And I guess from that age, she knew that I must have loved that song, or that song must have comforted me at one moment. And so every single nap time, she would play on this radio, Mariah Carey's Hero song. And I literally have like the vivid image of it in my head, even now at 30 years old, of me being 3-4 years old and this woman patting my back. Her name was Miss Lorraine. And everyone knew how much I loved Miss Lorraine because as a child, that was my nickname. My family would call me Miss Lorraine because I loved her. I would leave school crying because I wanted to stay with Miss Lorraine. And so my family was like, you are obsessed with your teacher. But when I think about it, it's because my teacher met my needs and I felt safe. I felt very safe with her. And so that's a very significant moment of my life that I will probably never forget. Even like I said, now at 30 years old, I haven't forgotten it. And I can remember laying on those little cots, the blanket over my body, the music playing, the lights dim, and Miss Lorraine rubbing my back.
Miss Lorraine, wherever you are, God bless
wherever
you.
Wherever you are.
We need to find her.
I know.
Yeah, and thank her. Those moments are so sweet. That's interesting that you said feeling safe, because something you actually mentioned just a little bit earlier was this idea of when we find our purpose, feeling safe in our lane. And I just love that there's this like redemptive kind of circle weaved throughout your life. You have also said that sort of transitioning into, because the bullying didn't stop, really.
Oh.
It just kept going.
It kept going. And I also was, in the midst of me being bullied, I was actually bullied by a household member. I have a sibling who we have a very, very, I don't want to say have, but growing up, we had a very tumultuous, a very horrible relationship. I'm getting tongue twisted here. And she had a lot of resentment toward me. And so I was bullied as a child outside of the home.
Wow.
Also bullied in my home. And those are moments that I haven't forgotten. Like I said, even now, these are things, our childhood experiences, we don't forget them, especially the ones that are impactful and leave wounds.
Yeah.
So for me, when it came to my relationship with her,
it was just something that was very, very toxic. Now I have the language to describe it, but I always knew that, like, we never got along at all. And so the bullying didn't stop because I came home to the bullying. And then that's why now, when it comes to a lot of the things that I talk about, when it comes to setting boundaries and practicing self-care,
but also see where that comes from.
It's because I had to grow up around a very dysfunctional person. This person is not necessarily diagnosed, but my assessment is her being possibly borderline, which is a personality disorder. And there's a lot of narcissism rooted in that, but a lot of black and white behavior. So everything is either good or bad, right or wrong. And so anything that I did was either good or bad, right or wrong in her eyes. And we would argue, right? And her perception of things were either right or wrong. So you either have to do this, and if you don't do it, you're a horrible person. And I'm like, no, I don't have to do this. There's like a lot of obligation from people who have.
So it's just like a maddening kind of. Yeah. It sounds like there was no place that you felt good outside of Miss Lorraine's.
No.
Miss Lorraine in kindergarten. There was no rest for you.
None.
And you're trying to grow up and make sense of. I can't imagine. I mean, just trying to. Being a kid just sucks anyway. Being bullied sucks anyway, and not getting any rest at home. I mean, how did you do it?
There's times where I actually think back, and I think that's honestly why I was extremely depressed. I don't even think I was doing it. Like, I was severely, severely depressed, and that's when, at 16, I wouldn't say that was the only contributing factor. By the time I hit 16, my father was severely ill. I was just exhausted by life and everything that was happening. And that's why I became suicidal. So when I think back as an adult, I learned so much, but at the time I pretty much had given up, because I remember the feeling that I had of like, why am I still here? I remember praying to God, like, when I go to sleep tonight, please make sure I die in my sleep.
Wow.
Like, just please make sure I die. Like, I want to go out the easiest way possible. Just take me out in my sleep. And I will wake up every morning. And that's when, I don't know where I maybe saw the idea of cutting or anything like that. I'm not sure where it came from, but that's when I started cutting myself. And I guess it's because I knew, like, cutting it at that time, like, the different ways I could attempt suicide. And so I started cutting myself. And when I started cutting myself, it actually became therapeutic for me. So I developed this negative habit of self-mutilation, because it was actually something that felt a little cathartic for me. So when I think back, I actually didn't know how to manage it. That was my way of managing it, taking it out on myself.
Thinking, I mean, it sounds like you did know how to manage it. It makes me think about the work ethic that you mentioned earlier with your family and your dad's passing. Almost the way that you started trying to process. To talk about how you were almost like a perfectionist at cutting, yeah. Because you were so good at it, hiding it.
Yeah. No one knew. And there were times where I was fully exposed and no one noticed my scars.
Did you want them to notice?
I think I did. I did. Because I felt like, another element too, when we talked earlier about the mental health component of like what mental health looks like and depression and the crying, I, again, always knew something was wrong. And because of the household that I grew up in, I didn't know how to talk about my feelings. Talking about feelings was not something I felt was really normalized, or maybe I didn't really see happen. I grew up with a very guarded father. My father was very, very guarded. And I actually think that when he passed away, that was one of the things that was, I wrestled with a lot when I was in therapy, because I was very angry at him. And that came up for me after his death, because I was like, I felt like I didn't get to know many areas of his life because he was so guarded. He wouldn't talk about many things. And there's a lot to my lineage that I wish I knew that I don't know. I have this man who's Panamanian, grew up in Colombia, came here on a boat, went to Miami, from Miami, traveled to New York. When he was in Miami, he saw a sign for Boar's Head. And when he was there, he got a job. Then he traveled down to his cousin's house in New York City and made a life here. Opened up a corner store and bought a house and did all these amazing things for a man who wasn't from this country. And I never got to really know much about his history. And I never, whenever I would inquire, he just wouldn't want to talk about it. And I think that got me so upset. It had got me so upset. And so when he died, I was just like, so much of you and so much of your memories and so much of who I am within you is gone now. Yeah. And I don't get to know about what it was like. I knew some things about what it was like growing up for him. But I think too, so I want to mention how my parents had a huge age gap. When my father had me, he was already 55. So I felt a way about it because I was just like, by the time you had me, you were much, much older. And so there was so much to your life that I didn't get to experience or learn about. And then by the time I could, you got sick. And so that was another thing where I would say my father, if I had his first heart attack when I was about 11 years old.
Wow.
From 11 up until 19 when he died, he was extremely sick. His just sicknesses got progressed.
Wow.
So I spent my whole life tending to him, his illnesses, but I didn't get the opportunity to really know who he was, especially because by the time I turned 15, he started to deal with dementia. So there were times where he would call me my sister's name. He would fight with me. He didn't know who I was. And so I had a lot of emotions about it because I was just like, well, now you're gone. Right. And now you're gone. So a lot of that played a huge role in just like my sadness in life.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And the fact that you were getting bullied for who you were and now you don't even get to know who you were. So it's like,
Yeah.
I'm not even getting the benefit of the hate that's being, I'm not even getting a chance to defend it. That was the same with my grandfather too. He got sick when I was a teenager as well. And I always begged him to like record his voice and tell me the stories, and he refused. And that always made me so frustrated and sad because it's like this loss about who we are and our identity.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's how I felt, you know, especially when your family isn't from this country. It's just something special about it. I want to know your history because my history is an American history. And so it's meaningful to know, like, well, you know, my lineage. Tell me about my family back home in Colombia. Tell me about my grandparents. Tell me about what you did when you were a little boy. Like, tell me about all those things. I've been to Panama, but I've never been to Colombia. So I was very... the part of Colombia that my family is from San Andres. And so I always wanted to go. I haven't gone yet, but I wanted to just know the stories. I know my mother's stories, you know, she's still here with me, but that was one of the things where I'm very proud of my family history. And like I said, my family history is not American history. And so you learn so much here in America about American history that you can only rely on your family to tell you about your family's history if they're not from this country. So I'm like, well, tell me, you know. And so I feel like I'm lucky though that my father had other children, and so with those siblings I get to know a lot about him because they know way more, especially since he had them when he was younger. So there's parts of his life that we got to share, photos they were able to share with me, things like that. But I think when he died, with that grief, those different layers of grief that come in anger, that was definitely the anger and the resentment where it's just like, how dare you? How dare you leave me?
Yeah.
And have all this stored inside of you and I don't know any of it.
Yeah. And you mentioned that he was so guarded already.
Yeah.
It just sounds so isolating, Mina. It just sounds like there's so much grief and there's so much isolation and so much misunderstanding. People don't understand you, your loved ones don't understand you. I mean, how did you even find the words to move forward? I'm just imagining that I don't know how I move forward in my story, because there are some elements that we kind of share and overlap, but I'm just wondering for you, how did you How did you wrap words about around your experience? Because you are making it physical by doing the self-harm and the cutting.
Yeah. You know, that's an interesting question. And it's interesting too, because a lot of my trauma has been, because of the trauma, a lot of my memories have been erased from it. So there are parts of my life and even my story that has some potholes in it, because there's just so much that I actually don't remember because it's too traumatic. And I just kind of stored it and compartmentalized and just pushed those deep, deep, deep in the basement. And I'm like, I've never checked back on it again. So there are parts to my story that just have those cracks in it. What I do remember though, as a kid, was I would make what we call vision boards now. And at the time I didn't know. And I would, one, I was always, I guess because I'm the youngest sibling, but my father's children are significantly older than me. And then I have my other sibling who was a bully. So I already isolated myself from a lot of people. One, that age gap kind of just makes you feel like you're the only child anyway, because you're 10, but your sibling is like 25. And then you have this other sibling who's bullying you, so you don't even want to be around them. And I was lucky enough to have my own room. At some point, me and my sibling, we were able to get our own rooms. And so once I got my own room, I was able to create my own space. And again, where that was learned, I'm not sure. What I do know though is having my own space and being alone was sacred to me. And so I would put so many posters on the wall of these words that I would carve out from the magazines. And I would find words like brave and courageous and beautiful, because I was like, I want to embody that. I don't feel brave and I feel beautiful, but I want to be beautiful. And at the time I'm only like 12, 13. And now as an adult, I'm like, oh.
That's amazing that was like growing in you despite everything. Yeah.
From the time I was a child, I loved reading. I loved, loved, loved reading. So that's why I always had magazines, because I loved reading books. That was my favorite thing to do. I love reading fiction even till this day. But I also liked reading magazines, because to me, reading magazines was also an escape. Like, reading fiction takes you into someone else's world. Reading these magazines about other people kind of took me into their world. And so I remember just always having a collection of magazines available. And then one day I was just like, I'm just going to get a bunch of posters and I'm going to cut these words out and I'm going to stick them all over my room. And that's what I started doing. And so, like, right now, journaling and writing is such a sacred practice to me, but it's not something I taught myself as an adult. It's something I've been doing forever. I've always loved reading. I've always loved writing. And when I got around middle school is when I started to create these collages, because I was like, this is kind of who I want to embody. And this is who I want to be.
Did you have anyone specific that you looked up to? I mean, I'm just like, where did this come from? Like, where is this little tiny seed of resilience and hope?
Right.
Like, where on earth did it come from? Because I'm not hearing anywhere in your story where there's safety outside of Miss Lorraine's class in kindergarten in the background.
Yeah. I think at that time me and her are actually still best friends to this day. So my best friend and I met when we were 5 years old, and her family embodied what I always wanted.
So you got to see somebody.
I got to see a life that I felt like, wow, I wish I had that. And I spent so much time with my best friend and her mother that was actually my escape. I felt even safer talking to my best friend and her mom about things that I couldn't really bring up in my own household. And I think that's kind of where that glimmer of hope came from, now that I think about it.
It's amazing.
In my household, I didn't necessarily, I can't say my siblings or anyone were people that I looked up to, and I didn't necessarily have a horrible relationship with them, but by that age, they were all pretty much out the house.
Well, I mean, I have a little bit of a disposition towards your siblings. I mean, one in particular sibling, you know, I'm just...
Right, one in particular, right? That one in particular sibling.
I'm just saying.
The rest, yes, the others, I mean, were already out the house, and I didn't necessarily...
I, something I see in your work a lot is this idea of being seen. And I think right now, especially being seen, you know, Mina and I are talking after COVID, we're talking now in the midst of a lot of racial riots, but kind of amazing what we're seeing right now within the community. I am so hopeful seeing everybody rise up and have a voice. But so I can see on a macro level, but on a really micro level, you know, going from being bullied and then kind of isolated in your home, depressed, cutting is by nature very, you're hiding a lot when you have self-harm, but you are being seen a little bit, just a little bit. And I wonder what being seen looks like for you now.
Yeah.
Because you are seen a lot. You're a mental health influencer. You're a beacon of light for a lot of people. And given where you've come from, how does that come together for you?
It's crazy, to be honest. I don't even think I've taken the time out to really absorb that. My platform increasingly grows, and very significantly, to the point where I'm setting these goals for myself and I'm meeting them so fast that I don't even have the opportunity to like sit in it. And I'm like, is this really happening? And so for me, it's like being seen online and offline. And so online, it's very clear that I've created this platform where I have a community. And for me, being seen, it's important because I'm trying to model what it looks like to be vulnerable. And I'm trying to model what it looks like to really just be human, to just really accept our flaws, accept our whole humanity for what it is. And I do that because that's something that I had to learn for myself in my journey. And so for my community online, I'm always trying to do these things like being on the podcast and writing the essays and showing up on Instagram, because especially as a Black woman, I feel like it's important for Black women and Black people in general to know that there's hope and there's joy, and those things still exist for us.
I love that. Yeah. I just think it's amazing that you went from being so hidden to being so vibrant now, and that there's kind of this arc. I mean, can you imagine telling your 15-year-old self that you'd be so vulnerable with people?
I honestly think about that all the time, like how my story has come full circle, because like you said, I hid myself for so long. There's days where I literally think about when I was in, I even remember what my room looked like. I had these purple walls, and I had all these artists hanging on my wall, and I had all these different collages, and I had like this whole shelf of these collectible toys that I didn't want to throw out from the time I was a child. And I would be in there cutting, like literally be in there cutting myself. And when I think about that, and that I was literally 16, I'm like, wow, like if you knew the person that you're becoming.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
One of the quotes was, I'm pulling myself up from my own roots. I need my roots to grow.
Mm.
Yeah. Can you say a little bit more?
Yeah. That quote was related to this idea that I always felt like I had to conform, and I always felt like I had to fix something. And I have recognized, no, I need this in order to grow. It was kind of this idea that I always felt like I had to start all over. Like, oh, no, I messed up, right? I got to do this all over again.
That work ethic. Recognizing,
yeah. Yeah. Like, and this failure at being human, this idea that like, I messed this up totally bad, like really, really bad. And what's the worst that's going to happen? Nothing. Nothing. You're just going to keep going on.
When did you realize right? that?
You said what?
I don't know. I'm still working through that. Oh, definitely.
And that's where that came from.
That hard work ethic. I mean, I'm still decoupling. I'm trying to decouple those two. It's really hard.
It's hard. It's really, really hard. That quote really was just like, I need my roots to grow. I need this. And it was also my story. Because I think a lot of the time, especially when I was writing that book, I was reflecting on the different areas of my life. And I felt there was one point where I actually felt ashamed, where I wouldn't want to talk about these things. Like, I don't want people to know that I was cutting. Mm-hmm. I'll tell them I was depressed, but I don't think I want to share that. I don't think I want to share the suicidal part. I don't know if I want to share that I've been on antidepressants before. I don't know if I wanted to, I'll tell people I've been in therapy, but the fact that I needed to be on medication, but that's my story. And I need, and those things are have played a vital role in my growth. And so that's where that poem came from, where it's just like, no, I actually need all of my humanity in order to evolve.
You've mentioned before that sometimes you had shame looking back, but now you have a different perspective. How have you come around to that different perspective?
It took a lot of time. I will say that being in therapy really helped, because I, as I said before, I started going to therapy when I was about 20. Yeah, I was 22 actually. So when I was 22 at the time, like I said, I started cutting at 16. My father passed at 19. So by the time I was 22, I had lots to talk about. lots to talk about. And during that time, I remember when I was 23, is when I started getting on medication. That's when I started the track of being on medicine. So I remember just being in therapy, and I was in therapy for about 3 to 4 years consecutively, every week. And that was just an eye-opener, honestly. Having someone who I could talk to, someone who could help me with my negative thoughts, someone who can help me reframe my negative thought patterns and how my judgments and perceptions about my behaviors and who I am as a person, that's really the work that I needed to help me get rid of that shame. Because again, it was just kind of like this thing where it just felt icky. It felt a little gross to admit, especially too, when you are the only person dealing with severe mental health issues. So I didn't have anyone in my circle who had ever been to therapy. They may have felt moments of depression here and there, but not to the severity as I have. That's where a lot of that shame came from, because I would also look around and say, like, why me? Like, what's really wrong with me that my friends don't have these issues? And at the time, I would say my family members don't have those issues. But then as I was going to therapy, I'm like, oh, they actually do have these issues, right? Because then you start to learn. That's when you, your eyes begin to open and you start to unlearn certain things. And you're like, oh, those behaviors that that person, or even like I said, the sibling. Growing up, I didn't understand it. And then as I got older, I'm like, this kind of falls in line with the mental illness. And so when you begin to learn all these things, and you can name, because it's so powerful to name your experiences. When you can't name what you're going through, you begin to feel like you're alone. You begin to feel like you're making this up or something's just wrong with you. But then when you realize, no, the name for that thing is trauma. The bullying that you dealt with, it was childhood trauma. Then you're like, oh, it makes sense now. Honestly, those 4 years that I was in therapy really helped me to reprogram how I thought about things. And I think too, what was great about it was that I was in therapy in my 20s, because that's also a time where it's like, what is it to be an adult? Right?
I don't know.
Right? I'm still trying to figure it
out.
So that's where it came from. It's like, what is adulting?
Seriously.
Yeah.
I just love how much joy you have, Nina, and I know that people are so, 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 so lucky to have you work with them, and I can see how the writing and the expression and how unique you are when you sit down with people comes through, and I just respect you and I honor you so much. What conversations do you want us to be having right now?
Lots of conversations. I would say, however, the top two that come to my mind is, one, committing to the conversation of practicing anti-racism, talking about race, reflecting on race, talking about implicit biases, challenging those implicit biases. I think that's pretty much the first and foremost conversation, and I just feel like it's very, very important. And also reflecting, having these conversations now and having them 6 months from now, and then having them 6 months from then. This is not a trend. This is not something that we just do once in our lives. This is a daily practice. And so I also urge people the same passion that they have right now toward having these conversations about race, check in with yourself 6 months from now and reflect on, has that passion dwindled down? And the second thing I want to say is mental health, because those two things are connected. And so I want people to continue to have conversations around what it means to check in on our well-being. What does it mean to sustain and nurture our well-being during these times? Because so much is happening and so much will continue to happen. That's the thing. It will continue. Life is going to continue to go on, and we have to equip ourselves with tools and strategies to deal with those stresses in life.
Where can we get some tools and resources if we don't have access to mental health?
So there's a lot online. My favorite website is NAMI or mentalhealthamerica.com. I also have a few resources on my personal website, www.minabee.com, where I've written a bunch of essays for Huffington Post, Conscious Magazine, Well and Good, which is a wellness blog. And so those are some resources where I've talked about mental health and I've talked about race.
Well, we will link to that. Thank you so much for joining me. I adore you. You're so special. Let's do this again soon.
I'm Jessica Minhas, and thanks for joining us on I'll Go First. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Our mission is to uplift and support you in your journey of healing. If you like what you heard, please subscribe, comment, and share. And if there's a topic you'd like us to dive deeper into or would like to share your story with us, we are available on all major platforms at I'll Go First and www.allgofirst.com. We'll see you next time.